The Guardian.
This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the renowned website builder that helps you share your story with the world in the most beautiful way. Establish a personal brand, portfolio, or e-commerce store at squarespace.com and use the offer code Guardian to get 10% off.
Football Weekly with James Richardson.
Today, drama at Anfield. Start of second half sees Gerrard walk on through the storm and then off again, very much alone. Worst sub appearance since Pele's lapel pins. We discuss it. Skipper himself admits he hasn't a leg to stand on apart from one he borrowed from Herrera. We round up that and the rest of the Premier League weekend. A big week for Swansea. Some good news at last for a Gary and Sunderland from Dead Poets Society to the Devil's Advocate. But does it make any difference? We've got all the rest of the news as well from the continent. Germany, Italy, France and Spain. The Clásico as Real go down again after last week's fish dinner. All of that plus posts and more in this Football Weekly. Let's get this underway. John Ashdown.
Hi.
You've been at a Wembley final.
I have, yep.
Jacob, you've been just everywhere, really. West Ham's first win in ages.
Yep.
Wow. Momentous things to talk about. And Greg, you were at the big game of the weekend at Anfield.
Yes, I was. Yes.
You saw it.
I saw it happen in the flesh. I was talking to Jacob before about how, you know, obviously I was disappointed that Gerrard got sent off as he did, and it affected, you know, Liverpool's chances of being able to come back and win the game. But it was almost like seeing a goal or something. There was a kind of
something to tell.
Well, yeah, it seemed like a dream. It was almost like a dream. We come out for the second half, and I reckon he touched the ball more times in that 38 seconds than Adam Lallana, who replaced it in the first half. Mm-hmm. Overall, he came out like a bull, like there was like steam coming out of his nostrils, and he bounded out the tunnel at the beginning of the second half. Then he had to, like, someone had to lead him back to the touchline to tell him, you know, when you come on as a substitute, Stephen, you have to actually do it properly. And you could see that almost made him even more angry. And then he just wanted the ball every occasion, and he got the ball at every occasion, played a 50-yard zinger of a ball across the pitch after crunching matter. There was so much in that 38 seconds to look back on, and then he was gone. Yeah, and it was shocking, you know. Like, everybody around me was just completely dumbfounded at what we'd just seen. And it was like him when he was 17. He did the hot-headed youngster, and it was almost like he was so angry at, not at the player he'd become, perhaps, you know, he can't handle being old, so why not try to be that young lad again? And he let the team down, but at the same time, it was just stupefying. The way, you know, watching was just incredible.
Yeah, at least he didn't swap shirts with him at half-time. There is that.
Mm.
But so he's going to get a three-game ban now, and there's only 8 games remaining.
He's just going to be ignored for those 3 games now, and he'll come back and he'll have to be on the bench again, I imagine. It's a strange long goodbye that we're seeing from Gerrard. And that's just the Gerrard stuff. We're talking about the match and it's
loads more. I must ask you, were you one of those people holding Balotelli back then? Was that you?
That was me, from row 66. I've got incredibly long arms.
Hey, time for some Juan Mata love. Now, Man United aren't a team for the neutrals, but I think everybody loved seeing little Juan Mata with his amazing brace, especially that lovely, greatest type of goal I think there is. I mean, some people love a crashing in off the bottom of the crossbar. I love a sideways bicycle kick myself.
I'd rather have a vertical bicycle kick than a...
Would you?
Parallel.
Well, it's just more...
Sideways looks more difficult.
Do you think?
It's more matrix.
I tell you what's most difficult. He did the sideways scissor kick, and the ball wasn't riding as it came off his feet. To get it actually to go, just straight horizontal into the goal is quite something, because it means you've got it in the sweetest spot you can find on your boot.
It's much better than that rubbish Rooney one in the derby, I reckon.
Oh, yeah. Shinned it.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. So anyway, the atmosphere must have been amazing, Greg.
Well, there was an extra edge to it, obviously, because Liverpool could go into fourth place if they beat Manchester United. It's Liverpool versus Manchester United for the start. I was really surprised by how well United started the game. I actually thought Liverpool's running last season, a lot of the players would be, you know, they'd kind of used to these big occasions and would rise to it. And I thought United, some of their newer players, such as Herrera, might be cowed by the occasion. And they weren't at all. And I think Michael Carrick deserves huge credit for that as well, because I think he's just a steady hand on the tiller there in midfield who kept it all ticking over. And they pressed Liverpool and stopped Liverpool being able to play out from the back, which is what Liverpool have done so well in this run. And not being able to do that, they didn't really have another option. Now, when Liverpool pressed United yesterday, United had the other option, which was being able to play it, clip it up to Fellaini.
And yeah, Fellaini, that wasn't their other option. That was their first option, wasn't it?
Well, they played. Yeah, but they played.
That's what they did. First thing they did from kickoff.
Well, they did that straight from kickoff. But I think as a team, when you're facing opponents, you get into the rhythm of knowing how your opponents are playing. I.e., if they're playing short passing, you get into the rhythm of knowing where to close the space down. Now, yesterday, I thought United did really well at mixing it up between the shorter passing game. Liverpool would harry them, and then they'd just go long to Fellaini, and Fellaini just didn't... I don't think I saw him give the ball away at all. He just didn't let any of Liverpool's midfielders get near him. So I think Liverpool really struggled to deal with a team that had two ways of coming at them and not just the one.
Do you think that Sturridge fits into that formation? Because he's pretty individual, and Sterling on the right was kind of wasted there.
I wonder whether Rodgers is punishing Sterling by playing him out on the right for his demands in some way and trying to put him back in his box, because it's odd, because Liverpool have been at the best with Sterling as a centre forward. Even when Sturridge came back, I think Sturridge's rustiness, not that he's a particularly slow player, but I just think at times I thought Sterling could have been played where Sturridge is, and Sturridge could have been played in one of the other forward positions and allow him to come back. I mean, it confused the opposition as well by, you know, them thinking that Sturridge is perhaps playing as a centre forward and him and Sterling could switch. But I just think he's playing Sterling out on the right. Yes, I mean, he essentially was throwing man yesterday. Hey, here's throwing man on the right, and he can take a bad throwing. So that was, what a waste. And he got so much criticism off the fans yesterday on the back of what's happened in the week leading into that match that I thought some of it's unwarranted. Because
the contract business.
Yeah, yeah. The demands supposedly of $150,000 a week. I mean, he needs to show that he's worth that, and he has played well for Liverpool over a season and a half. But you know, he's not worth that money. But at the same time, he has done an awful lot of good for Liverpool, and is a player who you don't want to kind of hound out of the club.
All right. Well, this second big game in a row for Man United, and second big win in a row, and after the Spurs game, was still a suggestion that maybe Van Gaal had got lucky, but he probably messed it all up again with his constant tinkering. But they look pretty good now, don't they, John?
Yeah, and it's amazing, really, that he's sort of, well, I don't know about stumbling, but he's found this formation that can get the best out of a couple of players in Young and Fellaini, who were basically had awful times of it up until a couple of weeks ago. I wonder if it's, you know, how much credit, I suppose you have to give him credit, but I wonder if it's a little element of, you know, when you've got a load of letters in Scrabble and you just keep moving them around and moving them around and moving them around, and then all of a sudden you realise you can put zoology on a triple word score or whatever, and he's just happened upon this formation that somehow seems to work.
I can't believe no one's made that analogy before, actually, because it kind of sums it up so perfectly.
Sometimes injuries to a big player might be the one that allows you to stumble upon a team, because Van Persie getting injured has actually allowed them to move Rooney back up front, where he is more effective for the team than in midfield. Luke Shaw getting injured as well allowed them to move Daley Blind to left back, where he's been a little bit slow in central midfield, and put Carrick back in and Herrera into the side. And a lot of United's best stuff this season has been when Herrera's been playing.
Right, and that spring cleaning they did recently allowed them to find Juan Mata at the back of a cupboard at Old Trafford.
Yeah, but to be fair, I mean, Mata hadn't been playing too well during, say, the first year that he's been at Manchester United. Right. And then out of nowhere, suddenly in this new right wing role for United.
Fake right wing role, Van Gaal says.
Yeah, has suddenly started playing well for them in the last two games.
Wow. All right then. So basically, Van Gaal out-tacticked Brendan.
Yeah, I think so. I think his formation was the one that kind of left the impression on the game. I think they forced their system on Liverpool rather than Liverpool forcing theirs on United yesterday.
Right.
And
Lou Van Gaal did the Brendan stuff in the papers before the game, a couple of papers where they're explaining how he'd stumbled upon this 3-4-3 formation and what a genius he'd been. I think sometimes he gets a little bit too excited with himself.
Well, obviously, I mean, there was a kind of I don't know, it felt apt almost that the 3-4-3 began against United in the 3-0 defeat, and you know, I don't know whether 3-4-3 will end against United after this defeat.
Bookending
the 3-4-3, but I imagine he'll stick with it because not many teams have been able to deal with it like United have.
Right. Skirtle out for another 3 weeks, do you think?
Probably.
That looked nasty.
Looking at that again, it seems like he could have very easily skipped over De Gea, and he chose not to.
Certainly did. Okay, well, 5 points now between Liverpool and the top four. Man United there in fourth. Is that gone, do you think, Greg?
Liverpool need to beat Arsenal in the next game after the international break away at the Emirates, which at the moment, Arsenal are in such good form. Liverpool aren't as good form.
I'm wondering, did you see the performance against Newcastle?
Yeah, and the thing is, they didn't particularly play that well and got the result, which for Arsenal is,
it's a fair point you make.
And finding another way to win is what Arsenal haven't been able to do, and they did that. So
right, with a little help from the referee not giving that penalty for Newcastle right at the death, which looked pretty clear, I would have thought. But yes, they were fantastic. Well, they had that brief spell in the first half where they looked really, really good. Giroud scored what? 2 goals in 4 minutes, was it?
I think so, yeah.
And then I'm not sure what happened after that. Even before half-time, they really lost their nerve.
Yeah, it just seems to be a trait of this Arsenal team that they start well. I mean, they did it in the FA Cup against Middlesbrough, where they were 2-0 up in the blink of an eye. And then just, I don't know, something sort of flicks in their collective mindset and they start getting nervous. Who was it who said that 2-0 was the most dangerous? Was it 2-0 or 2-1 is the most dangerous score?
2-0.
2-0 is the most dangerous score. Yeah. So maybe that's what it is. They're just terrified of this dangerous score.
Saying that 4-0 was the most dangerous score after what happened some years ago at Newcastle.
Right, yeah.
They've not been playing well in a lot of games away from home recently where they've not had... It's been a sort of surprising trait of the Arsenal side where they've not had a lot of possession in away games and they've managed to dig in sometimes and... whereas you'd always associate Arsene Wenger teams with dominating the ball all the time. And I think there was a run of around 9 games or 7 games or so where most of the time in away games they didn't have the ball.
Yeah, which I think popularly is seemed to have started with the game at Man City. But those were matches in which they kind of chose to.
A couple of times before.
But it didn't?
But whereas this seems... I could be wrong here, but I think possibly the Stoke game where they were 3-0 down at half-time, they had more possession in that game than Stoke. And
that's because they were 3-0 down at half-time. Stoke just will have sat back and let Arsenal have the ball for the whole of the second half.
Then the Liverpool game where they were pretty fortunate to draw 2-2. Again, they had very little possession in that game. That it kind of started then. So
anyway, you're right. That's going to be an absolute humdinger. Well, that's Easter Saturday, isn't it?
Yes.
Arsenal against Liverpool.
It is. Just one thing on the top four. Looking at the run-in between United and Liverpool, if Liverpool do beat Arsenal, if you get the points there, I think it could still be incredibly tight because you look at who United have got to play and they've got City at home, they've got Chelsea away, they've got Everton away, and it's not an easy game with Everton. I mean, probably going to be safe, but it's usually quite a difficult game for them. Then they've got Arsenal at home as well. So I'd say they've got a more difficult running than Liverpool, who now have Chelsea away and Arsenal away, but the other games that Liverpool have looks much easier than the ones that United have.
I think United popularly have the worst run-in of any of the kind of top four contenders. Chelsea staying top, they had a bit of a scare though. Yeah, the cases. I mean, they would have stayed top anyway, but they nearly saw their lead narrowed a little bit.
Yes, it was a strange, really strange game. There's been very Mourinho moments this season for Chelsea, giving away the leads and conceding the set piece goals against PSG to go out. You wouldn't normally expect that from a Mourinho side. And yesterday was actually the first time since the Swansea game in the middle of January where Chelsea actually got the second goal in the league and went 2-0 up and thought, right, it's done.
But it was a dangerous scoreline, wasn't it?
Very dangerous scoreline. But that's been the problem for them in the last few weeks where they kept drawing games, having been 1-0 up, not finding the second goal. Team would come back and get the equaliser and end the disappointment for them. This time, though, they Hull just came at them superbly, and Chelsea's defence was unusually poor.
Yeah,
Courtois particularly. Yeah. The amount of times he was
that Ivanovic or Courtois? Do you think he was most to blame?
Ivanovic is a strange one because I think a lot of people, because he scores these goals, a lot of people have given him a lot of praise. But there are a few Chelsea fans who said he's actually been a little bit dodgy recently in the last few months, and wouldn't be surprised if possibly Azpilicueta will take over right back and Felipe Luis will move to left back possibly.
All right.
Well, Courtois may have made that mistake, but he made some amount of saves to keep the score down afterwards. I think Hull had 19 shots on goal, I think, in that game.
Really?
Which is incredible.
The
against
triple
Chelsea.
Save was amazing.
Yeah.
Well, they certainly look like they need a break, Chelsea, although Diego Costa, there's a suggestion that he's still going to get called up for Spain, although they claim he's got an injury, etc. Sorry, John, you were going to say
something? No, I was going to make exactly that point. Oh. I think what was Chelsea's strength at the start of the season was they had this settled side when everyone else was rotating that little bit more. And I actually did some research before coming in. And there are 7 Chelsea players have played more than 2,000 minutes.
Ooh.
In the Premier League this season, yeah. And Costa's played 1,994. Of the other teams towards the top, Arsenal only 3 players have played more than 2,000. United only 3 players. United only 2, and City only 3. So that settled side, that sort of core of 8 that Mourinho picks week in, week out, you know, none of the other teams at the top have done that at all.
Right. What about Burnley? I bet they've got loads.
Didn't get that far down. Didn't get that far down.
Well, anyway, what an ace to find up your sleeve, Jose. Loic Remy, eh?
Yeah, you kind of forget a prolific striker he was last season. And he comes back on, you think, God, he's still around. And oh, he's still, you know, a good striker. Although the McGregor in Hull's goal, what were you thinking?
Yeah, indeed.
Yeah, but he's just, you know, he's just this player who's hanging around at Chelsea who can come on and is extremely deadly.
Yeah. So top four all win then. Chelsea winning at Hull. Arsenal with a victory at Newcastle. Man United at Anfield, all the way wins. Man City, meanwhile, who were at home to West Brom. They were at home, weren't they?
They were at home.
Yeah, they were at home. They won 3-0. We're going to talk about the square brick talking point, aren't we?
Yeah, so for the third time in about a year in the Premier League, you've got a case of mistaken identity. I think actually it was exactly a year after Kieran Gibbs and Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain, Andre Mariners, at faux pas against Chelsea.
A couple of weeks ago we had O'Shea and Brown,
which actually was, the referee said, wasn't a case of mistaken identity, but it kind of was. But where Gareth McCauley and Craig Dawson, who do actually kind of look quite similar, right. And they're both wearing the same shirt, to be fair to the referee.
Similar players as well.
Yeah, both defenders. Mm. I think you might struggle to separate their style of play, possibly, but it was a poor mistake from the referee.
I couldn't pick many baggies out of a lineup, to be fair.
No. So there are mitigating circumstances for Nils Swarbrick, but it probably comes to the point where you do need to have some kind of video system possibly in place.
Well, Tony Pulis was outlining exactly that kind of solution, where he suggested that a manager should have 2 appeals each match, and that would eradicate this problem of these gross injustices that are happening. There's some others are pointing out that you've already got 4 officials and another 2 assessors in the stand, so there's quite a lot of manpower already.
But they can look easily. The fourth official can easily look at the
video
screen
technology.
Right,
yeah. Mike Riley, to be fair, was kind of giving his assent to this as the head of the PG Mol. What's that? Professional
Game and Match Officials Limited.
All right, then.
That's what it is.
So that's kind of a... They've kind of rubber-stamped that, then, have they?
I don't know.
He said that he thought that it was time to introduce some form of replay assistance to referees.
Well, I don't see why. What's going through Craig Dawson's mind at that point, though? Why doesn't he go, actually, it's me, I'll go. And then surely that would just sort it all out. Then you wouldn't have to.
I don't understand what the referee's fear is.
They do try to.
But he could just walk off. He doesn't have to stay there going, no, you've got it wrong. He can just go, surely.
Couldn't he just swap shirts with Craig Dawson and no one would ever know?
With
McCauley, rather.
A minute into the game. Yeah.
That could become a tactic, though. Managers could say, you're the fall guy. If any of our players get a red card, run over and immediately say, it was me, and run off because you're the worst of our 11 players. And I don't even know if that's what referees are actually worried about when somebody says, it was me.
So someone should have done that for
Gerrard. I think they just don't like to listen to... They don't know. I mean, I think in a real sense, they don't want to in any way show any crack in their certainty, if you know what I mean. Anyway.
People say that would disrupt the game too much, and it would lead to too many stoppages, but you already get, there was already, how long was that game stopped for while the West Brom players argued the point?
And I wonder how long Pulis was really incensed for before he thought, well, actually, we're not going to have any suspension now because they've cocked it up and the player would have still got sent off.
And to be fair, the game probably would have ended up in a Man City win anyway. They had, 43 shots?
Yeah, but I mean,
it
happened so early, who knows?
Yeah, what I just said was nonsense, actually. Yeah.
Worse than the Gary moment.
Yeah.
Is that how Liverpool...
No, the Gary moment. Do you know what? We've got a coda on the Gary moment, listeners. If you've tuned in waiting for more Gary news, you're in luck because we've got more on that to come. Well, so much more to talk about from this weekend. Wow, across Europe, the El Clasico was played Sunday night. We'll get Sid's reaction. There was also the JPT trophy. We'll be talking about that very shortly as well, John. And, well, first of all, because actually we just tried Sid and got his answering machine. So what we'll do now is take a little pause and then we'll hit the bottom end of the Premier League and then all that other stuff to come.
This new year, make a resolution to dust off that big idea. This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the powerful platform that gives you simple tools to create a gorgeous website in minutes. With elegant templates, Getty image integration, and marketing tools, you can make your ideas resonate with the world. Try it at squarespace.com and use the offer code Guardian to get 10% off.
Football Weekly with James Richardson.
Yes, bottom six all lost. So in a sense, nothing changes, but in a sense, another week's gone by. Leicester and QPR running out of time. Burnley got beaten by Saints. Ooh, Fraser Forster. That's a blow, isn't it? He's kept more clean sheets than Graziano Pelle of late. So that'll be a bit of a problem for Saints, will it, Southampton?
Well, I think Kelvin Davis is one of the better understudies. I think it was getting back to 10 years ago when I saw when he was at Ipswich and England called up Robert Green. And I think they chose the wrong East Anglian goalkeeper at the time.
Right.
He's obviously aged a touch since then. It's a decade on, but I think he's an able deputy.
Wow. What could have been had it not been Robert Green?
I've always thought he had he's a really good shot stopper, but with the ball at his feet and sometimes dealing with crosses, I don't trust him.
Isn't that most goalkeepers apart from a very few in the world?
No, he can make some great saves. But sometimes he can be really quite dodgy with when he has the ball at his feet. There was a goal against when they first got into the Premier League where he just handed it straight to Van Persie and, it was pretty poor.
It's reminiscent of a previous Southampton goalkeeper, Paul Jones. He was exactly like that. He was a
Liverpool legend, Paul Jones.
Incredible. Boric with the ball at his feet on the other hand was a rock-solid performer. That's a bit of a blow for Burnley, but... nobody else actually won down there, so they didn't get left behind or anything. Palace continued their renaissance under Alan Pardew. They were, I think I'm right in saying, 10 points behind Newcastle and 8 places lower than the Magpies when Pardew left one for t'other. They're now above them. Wow. And Glenn Murray, once again, a protagonist there in that victory over Stoke. We should talk about Swansea winning at Villa Park and that reality check, as Tim Sherwood called it. Oof. Lovely little bit of wing play by Jefferson Montero, if you like that kind of thing, to set up that late winner from Baffert Imbi Gobis. Gary Monk.
Oh, yeah, and Gary Monk continues to do a good job. He's overcome all the difficulties he had.
Including his first name.
Yeah, he's overcome that difficulty,
John, we were revealing last week the extraordinary statistics about the decline in usage of the name Gary. If you missed it, listeners, 28 kids in the entire country called Gary.
John's gone downhill as well. He used to be number one every year.
Not in the same way, though.
No, it's true.
Not in the same way. Listener Rissil1000 posts in about this. The name Gary, he says re-Gary, the name Gary was virtually unheard of until the 1930s, when Frank Cooper rose to Hollywood stardom, having changed his name to Gary Cooper. Apparently he was named after the town of Gary, Indiana, from whence he hailed. Gary Cooper's been out of the film business for a while, so it's natural to expect a regression to the mean. Not so different, then, adds Rizil1000, to the Hollywood-charged upsurge of Thor and Loki. Which, you know what? That makes a lot of sense. Because if you go back to kind of Shakespeare, there's not a lot of Garys there. They're pretty few and far between. And that's obviously what we can expect from the future as well. Just prepare yourselves. Anyway, now also in news from the bottom of the Premier League, we do this Swansea winning up to the bottom. The Spurs-Leicester game? What on earth was going on there?
It was a lot of arrogance from Mike Dean.
Ah.
Yeah, is what did for...
Well, let's talk about a very unarrogant young man. Harry Kane.
His first hat-trick.
First hat-trick. For Tottenham. In the week of his first England call-up.
Yeah,
when they do actually the Harry Kane story, the biopic, this will definitely feature because of the hat-trick, but also the fact that it's so neat narrative-wise that it was against Leicester, where he went on loan, was a bit rubbish.
One of his loan clubs.
Yeah.
I was...
look at him now.
Chatting to Jonathan Liu of the Telegraph on Saturday, just after Kane had scored, and he was saying he'll never do this again, and what we'll have for the next 10 years is just people writing Kane in decline pieces and whatever happened to
I don't think that'll
Kane.
Happen.
I really hope it doesn't. I don't think it will. But it's a terrifying prospect if it does.
Mm. Although, we ought to point out, it wasn't the world's greatest hat-trick. You got a tap-in, a massive deflection, and a penalty that wasn't.
Got to be there.
Mm. Yeah, it's true, but still. One was almost an own goal.
John, whatever may have happened against Leicester, and it was against Leicester, you can't argue with the fact that he didn't start a game until November. He didn't score a goal in the Premier League until November, and he's top scorer now.
He's got 29 goals in all competitions. Yeah.
Wow.
So I think he must be on course to be the first Spurs player to score 30 since probably Gary Lineker.
Right.
I think that was the stat.
To say, I think he's built well as a striker, not to suffer a decline in the way that, you know, some players come through and they rely solely on pace and they're like greyhounds just waiting for something to go wrong and then that's the end of them. He seems to be more, he's just well-rounded. He's physical, he's reasonably pacey and he doesn't, you know, he's not always twisting and turning. I think he's not going to be susceptible to injury and therefore maybe, you know, more consistent over the years than people think.
All right. Let's hope you haven't just put the
twang
climb on. Absolutely. Yeah, anyway, because, you know, England's footballing future depends on him, I think it's fair to say, as they charge into this fixture with Lithuania and, of course, a big friendly with Italy and their collection of very, very Italian-sounding players, which follows that. Anyway, we'll talk more about that international stuff, of course, in the fallow pods ahead over International Week. QPR, ooh, that's an important win for Everton and an important defeat for QPR. We've now lost 5 on the spin at home. Yikes. Is that over, do you think, John? Crimson Ramsey's not giving up. Is he right?
Yeah, well, there's no need to give up quite yet. There's 8 games left. But they were pulled apart so easily for the 2 Everton goals. And although they're creating chances, which I suppose you can say is, you know, that's a good thing. They're just not, you know, they're not taking them because they haven't, you know, Austin's gone slightly off the boil and Zamora's never been a prolific scorer at this level. I think more worrying is Ramsey's kind of the fact that, you know, Wright Phillips was as thrown in and then thrown back out again, and the young fullback whose name escapes me,
Darnell Furlong.
Did he start last week and then wasn't even in the squad this weekend? So it's kind of, you know, he's just sort of throwing stuff at the wall and seeing.
Isn't that
seeing
the problem with the clubs?
It's almost like he's pulling letters from a Scrabble bag.
Could be,
trying to make a sentence. Trying to spell safety. Sorry.
Yeah. No, QPR, similar to other clubs who struggle at the bottom when they, particularly, and Sunderland say, you know, when you've had a few managers and a few different ideas and you end up with a squad that is kind of 3 different philosophies thrown in to one and someone picks it up and they've got all these players who are maybe brought in to do one job and manager doesn't think that job's necessary. And then, so Chris Ramsey's kind of picking up this mess and like Vargas, you know, he threw him in and he scored, but in other games he's been anonymous.
So to continue John's parlour game analogy, they're almost like a footballing answer to consequences, you know, where he met she at the, he said, she said, and the consequence was. And I think we know do we know what the consequence is? I don't know. Do we know what the consequence is for Sunderland? That's quite a segue going on here. Yeah. And you saw the Dick Advocaat debut at Upton Park.
Yeah, they played quite well for about 15 or 20 minutes and Connor Wickham had a shot, which Adrian saved, and then Jermaine Defoe went through and I was convinced he was about to score because it was classic Defoe territory and he put it high and wide. And they looked dangerous with the sort of a diamond stroke 4-3-1-2 with Connor Wickham floating behind Fletcher and Defoe. They caused a few problems for West Ham. And then in the second half, they really went off the boil. Advocaat said, sometimes you have to accept a draw, but I thought that West Ham, a little bit short on confidence, having not won for so long, they were missing 4 key players, West Ham, and Sunderland really offered nothing in the second half. They had one shot, I think, that was an actual threat from, and I think that was probably going wide for Van Aanholt. And the goal, to be fair, shouldn't have stood. It was a foul by Nene on Sebastian Larsson, but it was just, and Sacco scored. But it's just one of those things where they'd invited so much pressure and so many balls into the box that, you know, it kind of, you're not sure how much sympathy you should have for them simply because of the way they approached what was a winnable fixture for them. And
they made their own luck, Jacob, did they?
Yeah, and I'd say so. And but I think that in Advocaat's defence, he'd been there for about 3 days. He'll have now a fortnight to work out exactly what he should do with this team. They're still out of the relegation zone. They have the derby to come in a fortnight as well. So they've won the last 4 of those. And
All right, well, there are still questions about whether Dick Advocaat is going to be the man to turn things around or whether he's going to be the new Felix Magath or what.
I think he's a bit different to Magath.
We're going to dial up Mikael Jongsma on Thursday. Got a little bit of room to hear from Michiel Jongsma about that, about Billy Beane and his ingression into the Dutch football scene at AZ Alkmaar, and much more besides. That's a little treat coming up in Thursday's Football Weekly Extra. And on the subject of Thursday, actually, listeners, it's just possible we might have a spare minute or two. So if you've got any long-standing questions you'd love to see answered by the panel, which will include Pretty Spen, Ian McIntosh, Paul McInnes and Simon Burnton, that's very much, you know, just send them into the message board. Right. On the subject of messages, Van der Vaart next says, on the biggest football debate on whether or not you're allowed to say the MLS, or if you get sneered at, I recently heard, says Van der Vaart next, a radio interview with Mr. MLS himself, Bruce Arena. He referred to it as the MLS. All right then. Hey, John, you were at the JPT Trophy this this weekend.
I was, yeah.
Yeah. That was the Johnston's Paints Trophy.
Yes, it is, yeah. Yeah. Like pin number and similar.
ATM machine.
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah.
GLT technology. Anyway, tell us about it and this fantastic day out at Wembley for Walsall, the first in their history?
Yeah, first in their 127-year history. They took 30,000 down there, which I think was pretty impressive. Bristol City took about 40-odd. There was 72,000 just over there, which made it the third most attended game of the weekend in Europe, just behind the El Clasico and Bayern's home game against Mönchengladbach.
Oh, yeah.
And what we saw, really, was a fairly one-sided affair with Bristol City, clearly the best team in the bottom two divisions, scoring after 15 minutes and then adding another just after half-time, and fairly routine victory, and that's the first half of a potential lower league double for them.
Wow, because they could take the League One title.
Well, they're 10 points clear now, so they should take... If yesterday's day at Wembley is the best day of the season for them, then something will have gone quite badly wrong in the running.
Right, OK. Steve Cottrell's team then back and banging.
Yeah, I mean, he's got them playing so well. They use a 3-5-2 with the with wing backs, and the emphasis is very much on the wing part of it. And a couple of players that he brought in the summer in Mark Little, who plays on the right, and Luke Freeman, who plays just behind the front two, were absolutely brilliant. Freeman's one of those players that has clearly got the talent and the technique to play at a much higher level, but he's got the sort of Kumas-style build of, I think there's a few... teams have probably taken a look and had a few concerns about his fitness levels. But he was scurrying about dangerously for 90 minutes yesterday. I think he's a really good player, and
they're heading for the championship then.
Yep.
And what's been going on in the second tier of English football this weekend, John?
Well, it's another bad weekend for Derby, which seems to have been every weekend for the last 3 or 4 weeks. They've now gone 6 without a win, lost away at Wolves on Friday night, thanks to a horrendous goalkeeping howler from Lee Grant.
So from the automatic promotion places, they've dropped out of the playoff position?
No, now they're in 5th, but they've only got a point now above the 7th place team, which I think is Brentford. Then Watford, the leaders going into the weekend, lost at home to Ipswich through a injury time winner. Bournemouth go back to the top for the 6th time this season after hammering Middlesbrough 3-0. Bournemouth are beginning to look very good again. They had two
penalties.
Their
goal difference, 42.
They keep hammering teams, yeah. They keep scoring goals. I mean, they had a very dodgy penalty for their third goal, but the second was an absolute cracker from Harry Arter.
Right. Fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah. Really, really good goal.
25 yards hit first time, wasn't it? Just kind of stepped onto somebody else's kind of pass just inside.
Sort of killed it. Yeah. Sort of the opposite way to what you'd expect almost. That was brilliant. Norwich won again.
All right. Well, only 3 points separating the top four, Bournemouth, Watford, Middlesbrough and Norwich. Top three separated by just the 1 point. Boy, it's looking tight. But it really does look like Bournemouth maybe could be heading for the Premier League. My word. Right, OK. Notts County have fired Sean Derry.
Yeah, that was this morning, wasn't it?
That was this morning.
Which is a bit of a shame for that. I saw the chief executive saying that she had nothing but positive things to say about him, which is a strange thing to say. You just booted him out, but there you go.
Huh. All right, well, at least. And this weekend saw Europe crown its first champions. I'm talking about the Scottish Championship.
Yeah.
Yeah, AC Jambos.
Yeah. My knowledge doesn't extend to the Scottish Championship.
Right, well, I can tell you they were crowned champions after Rangers beat Hibs 2-0, which got their promotion bid back on track, Scottish listeners. Also featured that delightful scene, you've probably seen the Vine, when a Rangers player goes to collect a ball for a throw-in and gets greasy with a torrent of abuse. Anyway, Hearts are 23 points of second place Hibs. They can't be caught now, evidently. Rangers third, 3 points behind Hibs, but with a game in hand. That's going to be exciting. I wonder how many teams go up, do you know, from the Scottish Championship? Is it three?
Don't they have a playoff or
Maybe
sort?
They have a playoff.
Yeah.
There's only 10 teams in the league.
Two automatic and one from the
playoff. I wonder if it's one automatic and then one from
the... Three would be too many, wouldn't it?
Listeners, we don't know.
Yeah.
Right. Came in hand. If only we knew, listeners, how many teams go up automatically in the Scottish Championship. Right, well, next port of call is really naturally the El Clasico. Sid Lowe will be up very shortly. First, though, Jacob, you did the minute-by-minute on the Clásico Sunday night. What did you make of it?
Le El Clásico went Barcelona's way.
Did it now?
Yeah. It was a strange game, I thought, because Real Madrid actually played very well for the first 50, 55 minutes. And Barcelona really struggled to get the front three into the game. The midfield was slightly overrun. I thought that Luka Modric was the standout player on the pitch for Real Madrid and probably the best player on the pitch. In fact, really dominated midfield with his interceptions and the speed of his passing. And Madrid created a fair few chances in the first half. Ronaldo hit the bar when it was 0-0. They equalised after conceding a poor goal from a set piece. And then Bale had a goal disallowed for offside, where there was a bit of a question mark over whether it was or it wasn't, who exactly was flagged for offside, because it was possibly Ronaldo who flicked it on.
Yeah, suggestions he did that on purpose, actually.
And then right at the start of the second half, Benzema had another chance. He thought, this is Madrid's game. And then out of nowhere, it was a long ball, nice long ball over the top for Suarez. And he scored. And after that, Madrid just seemed to collapse. There was no
some
sense
some tape by Suarez.
Oh, it was a lovely goal. It was a bit like his, a little bit different, but the one like he scored for Liverpool against Newcastle, where and that time he took it around the goalkeeper. But this time he put it past him.
Also, that goal is a very un-Barcelona-like goal. Which perhaps Suarez has given him, you know, the ability to be able to score now because he's got a bit more physicality, hasn't he?
Yeah, but I just thought that Madrid, there was no conviction at all about them once they went behind the second time, which is a surprise given they came back so well with a superb goal. The flick from Benzema for Ronaldo was brilliant for the equaliser, and they had half an hour to score an equaliser, and just nothing really happened. I think Bale made two passes in the last half hour. Whether that's something to do with him not contributing enough, or whether it's that they're not getting him into the game enough, whether you have to get a winger into the game, and they didn't seem to be able to do that. The ball didn't really seem to come his way that much. And really what happened in the end was that Barcelona were the ones who were pushing for that third goal. In fact, it's kind of crucial that they didn't get it, because, of course, that a third goal would have wiped out the head-to-head record. But actually, what happened was that Casillas made a couple of saves, and Neymar, who missed a sitter in the first half, then went and missed a couple more in the second half.
Explain about the head-to-head business.
Well, Madrid won 3-1 in the first game.
Right.
Of course, if they finish level on points, then it's done on head-to-head, so Madrid's is superior.
Excellent. All right, well, time now to get the Spanish reaction. And this might prove a little bit problematic, but over now to Sid Lowe.
Hello.
Hello. Sid, is this a good time for you? Are you on a train?
Yeah, and I'm kind of wedged into a corner, so I can't really move, so I'm going to try and talk very quietly.
Who are you wedged between?
Well, I was stupid enough to say yes to someone who asked me if I minded changing seats. What she hadn't pointed out was that her seat was in one of those irritating fours by a table, so I'm now stuck.
All right. Are people looking at you funny?
Probably.
All right, Sid. Listen, Jacob's just given his appraisal of the match, and a fine appraisal it was too. What's the reaction been like in Spain? Has Gareth Bale been made in any way the scapegoat for the angry Madrid fans?
A little bit. I wouldn't go so far as to say a scapegoat, because I don't think it's not the kind of game that's produced scapegoats, but it is true that in the judgments of players, he's probably the one that's had the most negative judgments on him, and I think there's been a sense that he started the game in a much deeper position, so it looked more like a 4-4-2 than a 4-3-3, but that he then kind of drifted out of the game completely. He was absent, and there'd been two or three pretty strong remarks about his absence yesterday in some of the Madrid papers, but really and truly the response would be more focused on the fact that although they lost, Madrid actually played really quite well.
But some Madrid fans, there were some shots of trouble at the training ground after.
Yeah, I mean, that would have been around about 3:30 in the morning, because what happens is that Madrid fly into the airport, then get taken to the training ground where they collect their cars. to truth be told, the footage I saw this morning, which I only saw very briefly, it looked like it was only a handful of fans, presumably just a handful of nutters. And there were about 300 fans who arrived at the airport. They were there to cheer them rather than complain about them. And it's curious that Madrid, in a game that it does matter that they lost this and they're 4 points behind, and you expect to make life difficult for Barcelona. But there is, I think, they've taken, I would probably argue they've taken too much comfort in the way they played, considering that they did lose. But then it is a good sign in that with Modric, they controlled the game.
Oh, Sid, are you still there?
I'm in a tunnel, so I don't know how long this will last.
I don't know either. So I'm just going to move straight on and ask you, what did the Spanish think of the Champions League draw?
They're disappointed. They're disappointed fundamentally because they wanted two things. One of them they got, the other they didn't. The Spanish teams wanted, at least according to the way that it's been kind of portrayed here, the Spanish teams wanted to avoid Bayern Munich and wanted to avoid each other. And so the fact that it's a Madrid derby, I think is frustrating because as well you've got to look at it from a broader Spanish perspective and the joy, probably the glee at having so many, and particularly they the Spanish teams face each other because I think they thought there was a reasonable chance of them being three out of the four Spanish semi-finalists.
Wow. Yeah. All right, we're losing you again, Sid. Atletico, though, must be excited at the chance to get their revenge on Real.
Well, I suppose so. It's six games without losing this year. I think it's four wins and two draws. But since, of course, Lisbon, it is a chance for revenge. But there's a bit of me that sort of thinks it can't keep going on, can it? They can't keep beating Real Madrid. Maybe they can.
Maybe they can.
It just sort of doesn't feel like it.
All right. Well, the two finalists, of course, from last year's competition. Meantime, in other meeting up again news, Sid, there's PSG taking on Barcelona, who knocked them out a couple of seasons ago.
Yeah, and of course there's Latin going back to play against Barcelona. Although he's going to miss the first leg.
He's going to miss the first leg in Paris. Yeah,
which is a bit of a pity. I think actually the truth is that Barcelona, while of course no one's ever going to admit this, they're reasonably happy with that. I'd say that the key thing was not to play a Spanish team, not to play Bayern Munich. And I think once you've gone beyond those, obviously there was a sense that Porto and Monaco might be the easier teams. But I think Paris Saint-Germain, while they're strong and while they've been taken seriously and while people were impressed by the way they were strong, I think there's a sense that if Barcelona get it right, they should be stronger. And I think I'm not quite so convinced, but that's the feeling here anyway.
All right, well, Sid, enjoy your tunnel. I think we're losing you again there. So, listen, thanks ever so much. We'll catch up with you soon.
OK, I hope so. Cheerio.
Right, Sid Lowe there. Well, indeed. Of course, they were in the same group, weren't they, earlier on in this competition? Barcelona won 3-1 at home. PSG had the 3-2 win in Paris. So I reckon that could be quite a tight one. What do you reckon about the Madrid derby, Greg?
Well, I just think Simeone's a really good manager over two legs. And, they lost the final. It was a one-off occasion, but they play over two legs in the Spanish Cup and, Atletico come out on top there. And they've just got that grit about them that you need in, European football, those two-leg occasions. I just think that gives Atletico a lot of hope that they can keep that record going against Madrid and upset them.
Fair point. PSG, meantime, this weekend, going top of Ligue 1 for the first time this season. First time they've ended a round in first place. That's because Lyon, who were on top, lost against Nice. Marseille, meantime, by the way, Zlatan scored a hat-trick, but he's now suspended. He's probably going to be suspended in the league as well for all those comments he made.
Broken his ankle at first as well. Did you see the penalty, the first one?
Yeah, he really got clattered.
The keeper came out, his legs seemed to bend, and I was just so surprised he got up and carried on. So.
Got up, carried on,
good
scored
on
a hat-trick.
Zlatan.
And apologised for his comments the other day, put PSG top of the table and all that. Now, on top of the French table, you've got PSG 1 point ahead of Lyon, and Lyon 1 point ahead of Marseille now. A couple of curious things about Marseille, Jacob. All right, they went from the start of October to a couple of weeks ago without ever getting an away win. They were kind of QPR-esque in that sense. They then beat Toulouse, put six goals past them, and next game away from home, they go to Lens, and they put four past them. So that's 10 goals scored, two away wins on the bounce. They're doing ever so well. If you think that's an impressive stat, wait till you hear about Europe's super sub, Michy Batshuayi. Yeah, he's the fellow they're getting very excited about at Marseille, Belgian. And he's been taking up the kind of, he's picked up the goal scoring slack from André Pierre Gignac. Basically, they brought him on against Saint-Étienne. He scored after 55 seconds. They brought him on against Toulouse. He scored after 96 seconds. This weekend, Sunday night, they brought him on against Lens. He scored after 38 seconds. That is some impressive substitute work, wouldn't you say?
Almost as good as Steven Gerrard's 38-second substitute work.
Yeah, indeed. Anyway, so PSG taking on Barcelona, and yeah, it looks like they're getting a little bit of European know-how about them, no? The way they handle Chelsea. We'll see. Porto will have the chance to take on Bayern Munich. Iron Robin has picked up an abdominal tear. They're saying a couple of weeks out, but I wonder if that one could...
They lost.
They did, at home to Gladbach. Did you see the goals?
No, it was during the Chelsea...
Oh, right, OK. Well, yeah, it was kind of 4 o'clock Sunday afternoon. The normally ultra-reliable Manuel Neuer with a couple of absolute ricks. So it was a bad weekend for top goalkeepers around Europe. Anyway, and Juve getting Monaco out of the hat on Friday, which brought celebrations from Juventus fans in scenes eerily reminiscent of when Arsenal drew Monaco in
the 98 semi-final.
Juve without Pogba.
Without Pogba.
Yeah, he's out for 7 weeks. Yeah, so. Or more, so, perhaps. Mm. We'll see. But, you know, they got past Borussia Dortmund without him.
Mm. Shame there won't be Pogba v Kondogbia.
All right.
And they played together, didn't they, for France youth level and
French
teammates.
Oh, yeah, they're part of that amazing French side.
Yeah.
Cool. All right. Hey, meanwhile, Europa League, they had the draw for that. Of course, no longer any English involvement in this either after Everton's...
Not strictly true. You've got Mika Richards playing for Fiorentina.
Fiorentina, that's true.
And possibly, you know, Mark Clattenburg might get the final.
Right.
So,
fingers crossed. Away goals again, the problem for English football as Everton go down 5-2 at Dinamo Kiev.
What about Roma? What happened to them?
Ah, wow. Wow. That's looking quite incendiary, the situation there. They were title challengers. And since the turn of the year, everything's just collapsed. And the popular notion is that it's because they played a style of football that requires an enormous amount of self-confidence. And after Bayern Munich handed them their bottoms on a plate, 7-2, I think that game was.
7-1.
They've just been all at sea. And certainly since the turn of the year, there's also been a very questionable transfer policy operated by the club. The transfers haven't really worked out for them. And anyway, they've been drawing game after game after game. They were in the Europa League last 16. They drew Fiorentina. Drew the first leg away in Florence. Thursday night at home to Fiorentina, they were 3-0 down within about half an hour, at which point the ultras and the Cud of the Sud walked out and left a banner saying, you've broken our balls, Roma. And then when they came back in later on in the game, they kind of came back to deliver a message. And the message was, if you let Lazio get past you in the table, you're in real trouble. They basically did that thing where they call the players over and they're all there shielding their mouths. And they basically, you know... chew their ears out. I mean, sorry.
Dramatic images.
Oh, they were dramatic. Yeah. We've seen those scenes a lot. Also in Germany, with Borussia Dortmund were off kind of explaining themselves to their fans quite a bit. But yeah, there is that menace about, I don't know why, but there is more of a menace about it when you see the ultras doing it. Anyway, the message very much was, you've really messed up. You better not let Lazio get past you in the standings, Lazio, Roma's neighbours. So given that Lazio had been on a real charge, it was extremely essential that this Sunday Roma did finally get a win, because Lazio are now just 1 point behind them. Lazio also winning Sunday night. Anyway, Fiorentina are going to have Dinamo Kiev, the side who beat Everton, as you were just mentioning.
Last Thursday was a bit of a Serie A Europa League apocalypse, wasn't it?
Well, one team had to go out because you had the all-Italian clash between Fiorentina and Roma. But yeah, Inter collapsed against Wolfsburg. Torino were really unlucky. I wouldn't call that an apocalypse. They'd lost 2-0 at Zenit. They won 1-0 in Turin. And there was a... Glick almost had one at the end. So, yeah, but they went out. Napoli went through and Fiorentina went through. Roma, of course, got... Yeah, that's
for five, Napoli, I think the Europa League takes on more importance now because they may...
Yeah, but they've drawn Wolfsburg.
Well, I know, and Wolfsburg are very good. And Wolfsburg are going to qualify for the Champions League through their own league, likely, where Napoli are in danger of not doing that, although it's not to say that Wolfsburg will just suddenly throw in the towel in the Europa League.
Mm. Sevilla, the holders, won the All-Spanish tie with Villarreal. They now get Zenit, who put Torino out. And that's the Europa League. All very exciting.
The winner
about, club?
Oh, Dnipro. All right, Dnipro.
Club
they
Bruges.
Got Club Bruges.
Beating Besiktas.
That was fantastic. It was a really, really good win because it's such a difficult place to go. And it was a bounce. The place was bouncing. It was by far the most intimidating, scary arena on Thursday. And I thought Bruges played really, really well. And they've just won the Belgium Cup this weekend as well, I believe.
They, Club
and
Bruges?
They're top of the league. And it's just, it seems like a blast from the past. You know, a grand old club of Europe doing well in Europe again.
Excellent. Quick word on... Well, there's a couple of stories that are kind of imminent in Italy. One is, latest reports re Milan's takeover have the man they call Mr. Pink, on account of his ginseng-infused soft drinks, which are very popular apparently in North America, but by night known as Po Here Wing Ying Wang So, who has apparently agreed a deal to take over 75% of Milan. More on that when we know more. Final ruling in the long-running Calciopoli trial is expected today, although who knows? But if it goes against the federation, Juve have got basically they've got a claim for €500 million in damages. Yeah, you remember it was all about Juve.
But they wouldn't have those titles given back to them or anything.
Well,
like
they've
that.
Already taken them back. I mean, they basically just they just ignore the federation's numbers and say their own. And Parma, of course, last Thursday went bankrupt officially. As it stands, they've got to find someone who's going to pump in about €50 million before the end of the season, and that will enable them to start again. That will pay off the debts, and then they will just basically proceed as before. They'll be relegated because they're way bottom of the table, and they'll start again from Serie B. There is a fellow who says he can do it. We'll see. Right, well, we'll see. Anyway, maybe we'll know more by Thursday, when we'll be discussing the international break. We'll be down at Mikko Jongsma. We'll be answering your questions as well, listeners, if you send any in. Remember, on Friday as well, we're also at that place in London doing one of our live shows. Philippe Auclair, Paul McInnes, and Ian McIntosh will be on board for that. I think there are still one or two tickets passing, you know, changing hands on the black market. Have a look for inflated figures, but well worth it all the same. Many thanks, Jacob. Greg Bukowski.
Thanks, James.
Thank you, and thank you very much, John Ashdown.
Cheers.
Super. All right, listeners, see you Thursday.
This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the renowned website builder that helps you share your story with the world in the most beautiful way. Establish a personal brand, portfolio, or e-commerce store at squarespace.com and use the offer code Guardian to get 10% off.